I am just trolling.
From Yahoo Sports, this is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast.
Hey, get out of here.
That's what you're calling.
Sean is right.
The FC Yahoo Podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the FC Yahoo Podcast. I'm your host, Shahan Ahmed, coming to you from Playa Vista, California. Once again, joined by Joey Galino.
We have we're across the country today. We're everywhere.
Also coming in from, where are you coming in from? Henry Bushnell, first of all, but where are you coming in from, Henry?
Chicago, Illinois. And I would just like to make it clear that I know it's my first podcast in a while, but I am this podcast's designated penalty taker.
Hmm.
Wow.
Wow.
I might have to follow you or unfollow you on Instagram now.
We might have a Neymar Cavani thing here, huh?
All right. Well, before we go to Europe, let's start with the Premier League because a lot happened. And first of all, I think it's important to touch on the two Manchester clubs. Both clubs had insane victories, 6-0 for Man City and 4-0 for Manchester United. Now, Manchester United left it a little bit late, but before we even talk about them, I think it's important to touch on Manchester City. Sergio Aguero had a hat-trick, combining well with Gabriel Jesus. Otamendi had a goal, and then Jesus did get a goal, provided by Sergio Aguero. And then Raheem Sterling came in late and made sure he got his penalty that he earned. It was a thrilling weekend if you're a fan of either Manchester club. Now, both those teams are tied at the top of the Premier League, only separated by alphabetical order, I believe is correct.
Something like that.
No, it is currently, I believe, out of alphabetical order, which when it goes down to the end of the season, if we're talking alphabetical order, wow.
It's the only way Arsenal has a chance.
But, you know, going back to City, and we're going to start with them, they're coming off of 5-0, 4-0, and 6-0 victories. Also, 5 away wins in all competitions, 19 scored, only 1 conceded. One more stat I'll throw before I hand it over to you two. Gabriel Jesus, 979 minutes played in the Premier League, 4 assists, 11 goals on 20 shots, which comes out to a goal every 89 minutes. That's a squawka stat, but Jesus and Aguero, it's working way better than anyone thought it would work. Well, better than I thought it would work. Joey, what is going on in Manchester, and do you think that we all just missed the boat on this one?
Well, real quick, I want to point out one other thing that these two teams have not done, as stupid as it sounds. So still the only two teams in the league, I believe, to have not lost a match. And obviously they will at some point this season. But last year when we were on the pod, we were talking about how it was a big deal that Chelsea, yeah, they had a bunch of draws, but they also only dropped points, like all 3 points, on 3 separate occasions. They only had 3 losses. So if you can even just earn a point from these kind of fixtures, you're in good shape. However, what's going on in Manchester is I think you're finally starting to see the blueprint, the imprint, so to speak, of the two managers on both teams in the second year. For City, it is that incredible attacking contingent of 4 or 5 guys that just swelters opponents with skill and pressure and eventually goal scoring. This weekend, you could have argued that Aguero's first goal and I think his third were offside. But, you know, at the end of the day, like, that's not going to make a difference in a match where you score 4 additional goals beside that. You have a well-drilled team that moves the ball really well. So Pep's imprint is kind of starting to, you know, to show up on this team. And last year, even after they had that run of, 10 games unbeaten, I think, early on in the season, he still kind of pumped the brakes a little bit and said, hey, we're not fully realized yet. Well, now you're starting to see them be a little more fully realized. And for Manchester United, and Henry, you wrote about this this weekend, it wasn't so much that they were 4 goals better than Everton on that day, but they were opportunistic, and that's what a Mourinho side is when they win the league like this. And if you give them kind of an inch, that they will take it, because that's what the Mourinho teams do. That's how they play. That's how they're set up. That's how he drills them. And so when you combine the two the two styles that are being imprinted up there in Manchester, I think it's starting to look very familiar. And if it looks familiar on the pitch in terms of results, then it's going to start to look familiar deep into the season when these two teams are battling it out for league titles, because let's face it, that's what these managers do.
Yeah, going back to City, I think one thing you touched on is that they were dominant early last season. I mean, they almost looked unstoppable in some of those August and September games last season right after Pep took over. But there is something different about this. Like, it seems like it is more of a well-oiled machine. And Pep loves control over the game. He loves everything so, like, systematized. And I don't even know if that's a word. But
it is now.
Like, okay, yeah, there you go. And he just loves that, like, structure to the game. And that's what you see with City. I don't know if you guys saw what Tom Cleverley said, Watford midfielder. He says it was the best single, one of the best single performances, if not the best performance that he had ever played against. And that's like City just makes it so tough on opposing teams. And Jahan, as you touched on, like this Aguero-Jesus partnership really is working. And I personally, I don't think that's a fluke at all.
No, I think Pep Guardiola kept saying, you know, they have to work. A year ago, or the end of last year, I thought Aguero was getting shipped out for sure. The way that, you know, when Gabriel Jesus hit his stride, Aguero couldn't get in the team. He really could not play along. He had to come in late, and they really looked awkward. Even the start of this season, they didn't quite look like they gelled. But then something just clicked, and they've been playing for each other. They're looking to set each other up, which has been, I mean, it's been fun to watch. But when you watch those two play and the quality that they both have, it is scary. I'm not sure there's a better two-man attacking. I don't think you see two forwards that often line up in the Premier League. And these two are so good and play with each other that it is downright dangerous.
Yeah, and that's the thing with Jesus and Aguero is that their skill sets do complement each other because they both move really well. They both can play with the ball at their feet. And that's, you know, when you have midfielders who can find their feet and who can interchange and stuff, you know, that works. Now, like, I'm not sure that they're going to be able to play together 35 out of 38 games because I think there are going to be some games where Pep is going to want more control in midfield and he's going to have to sacrifice one of them. Like, for example, they still haven't played a really good team yet. They played Everton at home. That's the toughest fixture they've had. They go to Chelsea in 2 weeks. Like, I'm really interested to see what Pep does there and if he still plays both of those two up top together. But yeah, it is really working, and they're so potent. And one of the things with Aguero is that, like, he basically hit his expected goals on the dot last year, which means he was basically an average finisher. And we know that Aguero is not an average finisher. Like, he's at the very least an above average finisher, and he's a very good player in most seasons. And we're already seeing sort of that regression this season. Like, he's been unreal. His third goal, and City's fifth, I believe, on Saturday was just unreal, or weave through Watford, and the finish was really good too. So he looked back to his normal level of performance for City, and it's a really promising sign.
And I think you're right, they haven't played anybody yet, really, so to speak, but I was harping on this the first couple weeks of the podcast, and I think it's still true. You know, their first fixture this year was at newly promoted Brighton. You know, it's a nice coastal southern town where everybody was hyper excited and the team kind of played behind the ball a lot and didn't really offer City a lot going forward. City still found a way to win that game with two goals, but not six, but, you know, it was still a win. They've already won at Bournemouth as well. And these are the kind of things that people, I think, questioned about Pep Guardiola coming into the Premier League because it's old, you know, part and parcel now, and it's an old cliche, but it is a little bit more of a rough league. It's more of a brute, blunt force kind of league than the other ones in Europe. And when they can get results like that from these kind of fixtures and still be in first place and then dial it up against teams like Liverpool, for example, a couple weeks ago, who might figure to give them a little more space to operate, I think that it suits them well. And the point to make about that Chelsea fixture is it's coming in one of the other cliches about the Premier League at the very end of a big glut of fixtures. They're going to have the Champions League group stage game they just played, and then the Watford game they played. Now in 4 days, they're going to go to West Brom, and then, you know, a few days after that, they're going to host Crystal Palace, and then they're going to host Shakhtar Donetsk in the Champions League. And none of those fixtures are particularly daunting, but they're all coming so close to each other that then to go to Stamford Bridge, where Chelsea is going to make a statement, you know that could be a little tough, and that's where we're going to get another read on this team, in addition to playing a better team, just because they're coming out of that stretch of the schedule, and we're going to see, you know, what they're made of, for lack of a better term. But I think the point that was made earlier about playing for each other is good, because no, you don't have to be like this ball wrecking number six box to box midfielder to have a heart of the team. You just got to have guys who are willing to commit and play for each other, and I think that Guardiola's got that. For whatever reason, he's great at managing egos like this, and that's what they're doing.
Well, I think we should bring another team into this conversation, and that's Manchester United. Now, they had a fantastic 4-0 victory over Everton. It was Wayne Rooney's comeback to Old Trafford. Antonio Valencia with definitely the moment of the match. Woo. It was Nemanja Matic with the ball across the top of the goal on one bounce in the pouring rain. Just a volley outside of the foot. Perfect scissor volley. I don't know exactly. I don't think I'm doing it justice, but I think you should go look up this video. And you know what? That 1-0 actually held for most of the match. And Everton had a couple chances. Rooney almost scored. Gylfi Sigurdsson almost scored. It could have been 1-1 very easily. But United seemed like they were the better team, even without Paul Pogba available. And then Rooney comes off, gets a nice ovation, and United go on and score three more goals in the final 10 minutes. I believe it was 82nd minute onwards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people look at that and say, another match where United, you know, the goal or the scoreline flatters the performance. But does it? I mean, when you look at it, I feel like Jose Mourinho made certain changes that allowed for that to happen. I think that first change to bring in Lingard for Rashford, immediately you saw Lingard getting a couple opportunities. He almost put away and put them up that second goal. And then Ander Herrera comes in for Mata. And it seemed like they just had a different impetus to get forward. And those next three goals came. You know, Mkhitaryan got the second, and I think I want to shout him out in particular. You know, Philippe Coutinho, for as good as he is, in his career, the most assists he's ever had in a season for his club are 9 assists across all competitions. Mkhitaryan is already up to 7 this season, 5 to lead the Premier League in only 5 matches. This guy has been really good, and he got the second goal. He deserved it. He had a heck of an afternoon. And then, you know, Lukaku gets the third and made a point to celebrate. That was fun to watch because so often we see guys just go mute. But he showed emotion immediately and pointedly at the Everton supporters. And then 4-0 to cap it off. But so far, from what you've seen, I'll start with you, Henry. City United, which one has impressed you more in the early part of the season?
So I think I want to say United has impressed me more, but mostly because I wasn't sure what to make of United going into the season, and I was more sure that City were going to be this dominant force based on what we saw last season. United were sort of dull going forward for a lot of last season, and we've seen them, as you just explained, like they've broken out in, especially, I think, what, it's 9 goals in the last 10 minutes of games, or maybe 8 goals in the last 10 minutes of games, something like that. Which is, like, part of that is just, I think, like, randomness and flukiness a bit. But this team is, you know, to go to what you're talking about, like, Mourinho makes changes. But another big part of it is that he has the personnel to make those changes. Like, when you can bring Martial and Lingard off the bench, and, if Rashford doesn't start, you can bring him off the bench. These guys are just incredible on the counterattack. And Mourinho, he has personnel to play in the counterattack. We know that his team, like, he can set his teams up to play on the counterattack. And that's just, so it's just a product of how the games have gone. As games drag on and as teams have to, like, throw more numbers forward when they're down, then United, more than any other team, is going to be able to hurt them. And that's why they've been so impressive.
Yeah, none of these late goals seem like flukes, do they? It seems almost by design, and the way that United ramps it up and really pushes on the counterattack late in matches, I think speaks to the fact that these are impressive. I mean, it's doesn't seem fluky to me anyway.
The one thing I'd say that is fluky, though, or not necessarily fluky, but might not be sustainable, is that in 4 of these 5 games, they've gotten the first goal, and that's allowed them to play on the counter. And I think 2 of the 4 have been set pieces. And 1 of the 4 was Antonio Valencia's worldie on, what, Saturday or Sunday?
Yeah,
Sunday.
The fourth minute, so very right. Early on.
Right. So, and the one game they didn't get the first goal was the Stoke game, and that just turned into, like, a really weird game. Both teams scored on set pieces. So I want to gather a bit more evidence on how they respond when they go behind or when they don't have a first-half lead. Because that's the other game that they won and scored late but sort of struggled was the Leicester game, where it was 0-0 at halftime. So I'm not all in yet, but yes, certainly promising signs.
Yeah, I think if you had actually asked me to pick between these two clubs as to who's more likely to win the league, I would actually say United, and it's not because I've necessarily been more impressed on a pure level with Manchester United than City, but I've seen this work before with Mourinho, and Henry's right in terms of, you know, you'd like to get a little bit more of a sample size in terms of how they win games where different things happen. They fall behind. Maybe it's 0-0 very late. Maybe they're the ones being frustrated and being allowed to have the majority of the possession, things like that. But I also know that this is – when I called them opportunistic earlier, it's no, you're not always going to get a wonder goal like you got from Valencia. But, you know, you've seen Mourinho teams kind of either take advantage of something that's gifted to them early or lie around and wait for their chance to poach and to strike and then take control of the match kind of from there. And I also want to kind of shout out Manchester United's defense, which has only given up goals so far in the league against one team, Stoke City, to the same player who got both goals. Choupo-Moting, is that his name?
Choupo-Moting.
Yeah.
And so the only other goals they've given up this season across any competition is to Real Madrid, and there's no shame in that. So I think Eric Bailly, Phil Jones, he's a guy who seems like he's been there forever, but he's, you know, he's solid, and obviously De Gea is a great keeper. And, you know, they faced Chicharito, they faced Jamie Vardy. Like, they haven't faced, you know, any of the major clubs yet, but they've held in check, so to speak, certain strikers that are, if not among the very best in the league, are upper crust for sure. So I think that that's kind of been a little bit of underrated part of their start to the season so far. And again, that kind of falls down to shape and discipline and doing what Mourinho wants them to do and being protected in the front by Nemanja Matic and even without Pogba this past weekend. And you kind of figure, like, what's an ideal midfield pairing? Well, it'd be two big, tall, fast, athletic playmakers on both sides of the ball, Pogba going forward, Matic going back. And I'm not saying they couldn't do the opposite, but with that midfield pairing out of the question, they were still able to get a convincing result against Everton. And I think that bodes well. And it's just, you know, the familiarity with what's happening here in this league as opposed to the familiarity with what's happening in Manchester City at the Etihad that hasn't quite been proven to be overly effective yet. I'm not saying it won't be, but yet.
I think the one big thing with Pogba's absence, though, is that, and I think it did show on Sunday a bit, is that in the middle of that game, like late first half, early second, they sort of lost a bit of control over the game. They didn't have, I think Everton had more of the ball, like in that middle, you know, two-thirds of the game, basically. And I think that's where Pogba hurts, because with a midfield of Fellaini and Matic, you don't have that guy who, you know, a defender can pass in the ball or a winger can pass in the ball, and you know he's not going to lose it. And so you can't keep that possession, you can't keep that control over the game, and that's what, like, he's going to hurt them in, his absence is going to hurt in every single game that United plays without him, just because he's so multi-talented and he's so good in any type of game. But that's sort of how it manifested itself on Sunday, and that's when, like, Everton had chances, and that game very easily could have been 1-1 in the 70th minute, and we'd be having a different conversation right now. And I think that's important to point out, but yes, that said, like you can stick Fellaini in there, you can even stick Ander Herrera in there, who can do a defensive job. They're still going to be very solid.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to follow up on that. Yeah, that was one thing where I think Jose got it right, was that, you know, he put in Lingard to push the action a little bit further, higher up the pitch, and then the Ander substitution, I think, speaks to Pogba not being there, because he was meant to come in and play some of those passes and kind of get the action moving a little bit further forward from the midfield. But we'll move on from City United, because I think we could talk about these two teams ad nauseum. Let's talk about the other big match, or really the big match of the weekend, which was Arsenal at Stamford Bridge against Chelsea. Now, this was a 0-0, but it didn't really feel like a 0-0. It felt like there's a lot of meaning behind this 0-0. And let's start, first of all, by Arsenal looking like the better squad. They looked like the better team with the better chances, and they didn't have Mesut Ozil. They didn't start Alexis Sanchez. Joey, what was Arsene Wenger doing, and how did it work?
At this point in his career, I'm not sure I'm willing to give him credit when he gets something right. That bias, I admit that's unfair. But I think that by keeping Ozil and Alexis Sanchez out of the lineup, and I think a lot of people would agree that those are their two best players. Sanchez for sure is the best player, and Ozil is the best, one of the best on his day, which happens more often than not, but there's still enough absences that are curious to make you wonder. But by not having those two in there, you kind of, and you're going to Stamford Bridge where you've had hellacious embarrassments, especially recently, you're kind of telling the rest of the guys, in a way, you're on your own. You know, no matter how we line up, no matter what we do, you're on your own. And Arsenal played with a commitment that you don't often see them play with away in the big matches. There used to be about pragmatism with Wenger and how he would play open and, you know, kind of concede space and areas to run into and maybe play into the hands of the better teams, the upper crust in the Premier League. That would be a problem, and that would result 6-3s and 4-1s or 5-1s at Liverpool, 6-0s at Chelsea. This time around, I feel like that the positioning was sound defensively, and it almost had to be because there's no it, – it's almost like a yin and a yang kind of thing. It's almost like, you know, a necessary evil, but it's also evil. It's like you don't necessarily have that one player who's a match winner on any given day like Sanchez in there, but it forces everybody else to be better and to remember what they've been coached and what they've been drilled on heading into the match. And they just played with kind of like this vigor and spirit that I think, like, I hate words like that because it's so like mealy-mouthed and it's just abstract. But I think it is true. I think you saw Arsenal play harder this game than they have at the top six sides in recent years. I think part of it's due to the fact that they didn't have those crutches to lean on. And was it beautiful? No. Was it something necessarily that, you know, as Henry noted this in one of your columns, is it something that's going to please the legends of the club? No, it's not. But it was an effective result. And I feel like we often talk, you know, Arsenal often talk too much about playing beautiful football as opposed to getting results. That's how you win in the Premier League over everything else. You can look great on your day and lose 2-0 or something. Just get a result. And they did that. And that has to be something.
Yeah, and a 0-0 at Stamford Bridge is a good result in the Premier League. And especially when you take into account that Danny Welbeck and Alex Iwobi, two guys that do work hard, were doing exactly what you expect them to do. Now, Alexis Sanchez is probably a better goal scorer.
Yeah.
You may have gotten a goal from him, but it's still, it sent the right message, I thought. Henry, what are your thoughts?
Right, and that's the thing. Like, I think the big question is, like, how much of this performance was connected to Welbeck and Iwobi being in there instead of Sanchez and Ozil? Because I think part of it is structural. Like, when you put, especially, like, Sanchez to some extent, but especially Ozil on a team, like, part of what makes him so dangerous is that he floats all over, and he's so hard to keep track of, and that when he can float into space, like, between the defensive and midfield lines, and when he picks up that ball, like, he's really tough to stop and he can pick any pass on the field. But the flip side of that is obviously that when he's floating, he's not in position defensively, and he's just, I mean, he's not a good individual defender. That's just, like, not part of his skill set. Would Arsenal have been able to do this with Sanchez and Ozil on the wings instead of Iwobi and Welbeck, or even just Ozil in there instead of Iwobi? And, like, I don't think they would have been able to. And I think that's, like, the discipline, the positional discipline of those two players really allowed them to be so compact. And it was still impressive that they created enough chances to win that game, even without those two in there. Like, Ramsey, Lacazette, those guys had chances. And, like, they very easily could have won, and then we'd be raving about Arsenal right now.
Yeah, Hector Bellerin looked really good getting down, bombing down the sidelines and creating chances that, frankly, Welbeck should have had a goal on one of those headers. But everything considered, right now, Arsenal have, you know, two defeats, two wins, and one loss in their first five, and they're already 6 points back of the two Manchester clubs. Chelsea is still within touching distance. They're only 3 points back, and they're in third place on 10 points after five matches. So, I mean, the way the Premier League's shaping up, it seems as though the two Manchester clubs are out in front, and Chelsea's probably going to be their number one, you know, rival, unless Newcastle actually hangs around or Spurs start winning at Wembley, which, Henry, you want to add something real quick?
Yeah, I was just going to say, like, that. I think that's the thing. Like, you have to consider this Arsenal performance alongside what they've done so far. It was like a 90th percentile performance from everybody behind their front three, and that's just not – they've shown time and time again in the past that that's not going to hold up, and, like, it was only enough to get one single point. So, yeah, I don't see them challenging those. Yeah, I really think it is maybe a top three or maybe a top four right now.
Yeah, well, speaking of that fourth, I just want to touch on Spurs. And so last year, I mean, we're going to talk Wembley, all right? Let's not beat around the bush at all. But last year, Spurs were unbeaten at White Hart Lane, 21-2-0. At Wembley from September 2016, so going back to when they started playing there last year, until now, they have four defeats, three draws, and only two wins. This is their home. This is Wembley. And those two wins include the win against Dortmund. Now, is the curse real? I guess that's a simple question. You guys have watched Spurs play. Joey, is there a curse?
Yeah, there is. And I'll tell you, it's not because there's something supernatural going on at Wembley. There's no ghosts that inhabit Tottenham when they play there. It's a curse until it's not, and it's on them to change it because they're a better side than what they showed on Saturday. You know, I don't understand how you can go from beating Dortmund, which is, you know, had some talent siphoned away from it and maybe is not as good as some of the teams in the past that they've had, but still a really strong elite European side, and you look very good against them. And then you come home and you play.
And also, Dortmund had a goal wrongly ruled
they
offside.
Did. Right.
It was a heck of a goal, too.
Right. But, you know, you go from that performance, and then you go to the one on Saturday, which wasn't necessarily poor from Spurs, but it wasn't enough to beat, you know, a team that's going to be battling relegation, and you see these kind of performances over and over again, and you're not entirely sure why it happens, because, you know, teams have come in here and they don't fear Tottenham in this particular spot, and until Tottenham changes that, it's going to keep happening like this. And if you ask me, a curse is a curse until you prove it's not.
Henry, do you think that Wembley is going to be the reason Spurs aren't actually able to compete this year, or do you think that they're going to get over this hurdle and before we know it, we'll look back at Wembley and just laugh?
The second thing. Like, there is no curse. Joey, come on. It's what, three games? You're basing this off three games, basically?
Going back to last season.
I'm more speaking like a coach, you know.
Then you have to consider the Dortmund game, too, when they were awesome. And, I mean, like, Dortmund played well, too, and that was a somewhat even game, but Spurs just converted chances. And then they don't convert at home against Swansea. Like, at the weekend, like, so, and part of that, I think, was Swansea, too. Swansea were just really good defensively, and I think you have to give them a lot of credit. But Spurs still, like, they had chances to win that game. Harry Kane at the crossbar. Like, if you want to say that there's some curse that makes them miss chances, like, fine, okay.
No, but I don't want to say that. That's not what I said. I'm just, I was being like, the impetus is on you, Tottenham. And I'll tell you what. They're playing Barnsley at home in the League Cup, I think tomorrow or Wednesday. And if they lose after that, or if they lose or don't get a result from that match and have to have a replay, all right, you know, I'm just...
Okay, well, then there's a curse. If they lose to Barnsley, okay, fine.
Well, I think for me, the point goes to something that we actually see in LA and other sports, in NFL in particular, is stadiums not being able to sell out. And that's kind of what Spurs are dealing with right now, whereas White Hart Lane was a sellout every single time. You had this incredible atmosphere. Fans were on, you know, it was a different, like, and not just talking about the pitch being slightly smaller for White Hart Lane. I'm talking about Wembley is not going to be sold out when you're playing Swansea or Burnley or, and those teams are still bringing it, but Spurs don't have quite the same type of crowd atmosphere that they did previously, and it's an adjustment. So, okay, curse may be a strong word, but I think their home field advantage is a little bit, it's weakened. It's not quite what it was. And I just talked about last year, they went 21-2-0 at home. Like, that is impressive at White Hart Lane. At Wembley, they could not replicate that even while they were doing that at White Hart Lane last year. So to see them this year struggle, yes, they've had the win against Dortmund, and they played well, and Dortmund actually played pretty well there too. But that was a special night when the crowd is going to bring it. You're talking about a Champions League night, a European night. On a day game when you're playing a bottom team or a bottom 10 team in the Premier League, it's not quite going to be as much of the atmosphere home crowd. So, Henry, if you'd like to respond, because you don't think it's real.
I mean, the only thing I'd say to that is that, like, was White Hart Lane really rocking for a normal Saturday afternoon against Burnley last year either? Like, okay, maybe it's a bit more intimidating, or maybe it's a bit more comfortable, but...
Oh, when the like, Spurs...
basically what I'm saying is I think we just need to see them play a bit more at home at Wembley in the league, and then we can start. If they are still in November, then I think it's time to maybe talk about that and talk about the real issues. But I mean, Pochettino has said that it's not an issue. I'm not ready to go there yet.
I think ultimately it boils down to I agree. I don't think that this is going to be a problem for very long. I think we are going to look back and laugh at this. I think it comes down to one thing that athletes, no matter what sport it is, talk about all the time, is like habits. And you know, some people say even virgin to like superstitions or whatever, but like players like to go through the same warm-up processes. They like to wear the same, you know, boots on a certain day. It's like there's all sorts of like stuff that they get used to. And on some level, I have to believe that applies to what you were talking about, Shahan. Like, the kind of stadium you're playing in, when it's 40,000 people max or something, and it's just so much more, like, you know, compact. And I think Arsenal had kind of the same problem when the Emirates was finished and you moved away from Highbury and you have a much more, like, corporatized kind of stadium, which is what Wembley is. I think once they get used to this more open, less sellouts kind of deal, then I really do think that factors into their psyche, and I think it's going to factor into the performance. And with all the talent that they have, it's hard to see them not winning there consistently throughout the season.
Yeah, once they get used to it, they'll just have to move to the new White Hart Lane. So yep. That'll be
readjust.
Okay, well, before we leave the Premier League, I just wanted to quickly touch on a couple things, and we'll see how long this goes. So Liverpool, first of all, I think is worth just mentioning. Last weekend, they had the loss to City with the Mane red card, and then they had a draw in the Champions League with Sevilla, and another draw on the weekend against Burnley. Liverpool, I mean, you know, looking at these three fixtures coming in, I kind of circled them and said, we're going to see their squad depth. That was before the Mane red card happened. And, you know, they didn't start Coutinho in the Champions League. They started him on the weekend. But going to Daniel Sturridge as a starter, it seemed a little bit off. It just didn't quite fit with what I expected of Liverpool this season. Something just doesn't quite feel right. And you know, that wasn't one of the teams we mentioned earlier when we were talking Chelsea and the Manchester clubs. What do you make of Liverpool's start so far, Henry? And do you think that they're going to rebound and be a legitimate Premier League title threat?
It's still the same old issues, isn't it, under Klopp, that they struggle to beat these teams from the bottom half of the table. And they haven't really done anything in the transfer window. They haven't really done anything tactically to fix these issues. And that, until further notice, that's still going to hold them back from really challenging for a Premier League title, in my opinion.
Yeah, I just want to add real quick, Burnley is actually tied with Liverpool on points, so they're not really the bottom half of the table.
Well, the non-traditional big six teams, you know what I mean.
I'm just saying they're tied for fifth at this point. Joey, what have you seen from Liverpool?
I think the problems are still there. I think that it's easy to kind of lean on the defense and say it's not that great. I don't know if it's necessarily a malady, but it is an issue. I think they could be stronger back there. Moreover, I think it's just every time out with Liverpool, I see, you know, Mo Salah had a great match on Saturday. Otherwise, I'm not really sure who would get more than like a 7 or an 8 in a player rating. And I feel like you can point to a number of occasions like that this year already where Liverpool has one or two guys play really well, but they never really play well together. And obviously, part of that was overcoming the not the loss, but the lack of Coutinho early on, and kind of now they have to work him back in. So I expect things to smooth out a little bit for them. The City loss was nowhere near as bad as the 5-0 scoreline made it look like, but it was still, you know, a loss to Man City, and we're all pretty sure Man City's the better team at this point. Just, you know, something's not clicking under Jurgen Klopp, and after a certain point, you can point to a lot of different excuses for that, but, and I'm not saying he's making excuses, but I'm saying, like, when we evaluate Liverpool, maybe eventually we're just going to have to say, like, you need to bring in better players or different players, or else this isn't going to work.
You know, I'm not necessarily saying I believe this, but I think it's worth sharing. I saw Sky Sports compiled the record in the last 100 games for the top managers from the top five leagues, just for league games. And the top of that list is Antonio Conte with 79 wins out of his last 100 matches.
Wow.
Of course, this goes back to when he was with Juventus. Massimiliano Allegri is second on the list with 75 wins. Ancelotti third. Guardiola fourth. Simeone fifth. Wenger sixth, huh?
That's about where his team's going to finish.
Seventh is Pochettino. Eighth are Mourinho. And then ninth with 48 wins in his last 100 league games is Jurgen Klopp.
Wow.
171 points he's pulled off of his last 100 league games. So of the top managers we see in England currently, it seems like Klopp has struggled the most. And, you know, a lot of this obviously goes back to, you can look at it and say Pep was at Bayern and dominating there for a little while, Carlo Ancelotti. You can look at PSG. So take it with a grain of salt. But it does, you know, I thought it was worth sharing that when you look at the top managers in the Premier League, Jurgen Klopp has had the most trouble recently.
Plus, when the form swings so violently from against the great teams in the league to the bottom feeders or even the mid-table sides like Burnley is right now, you would probably argue there's something there that's not working.
Yeah, and part of that also is, you know, that's, I mean, some of it is just like selective endpoints, but that also takes into account Klopp's last season at Dortmund, where he had some of the same issues that he's having right now at Liverpool, in that they didn't perform well against the bottom half of the league, and that's one of the reasons they were in, like, I believe they were in the relegation zone in the Bundesliga, like, midway through that season, the one that he eventually left at the end of. So, yeah, it's the same thing for roughly 3 years now.
Yeah, I mean, to also, just to add to that, the Mourinho season at Chelsea where he got sacked, also taken into account there, but he's still hanging tough well ahead of Jurgen. So a few blow-up seasons in the middle. But anyway, it was just an interesting thing. But speaking of, you know, blow-up seasons, I think we should end the Premier League talk with Crystal Palace, the first team in the history of English First Division football to start the season with 5 defeats and not having scored a game. Or not having scored a goal, sorry. And next up for them is a couple trips to the Manchester clubs that we just spoke about, followed by a match against Chelsea. This team could start the first 8 matches of the season without scoring a single goal. Oh, poor Roy Hodgson. Any comments for Crystal Palace? Any sympathy for Crystal Palace from either of you guys?
I don't have sympathy for... I have a little bit of sympathy for the players, although it kind of boils down to them in some senses. I have sympathy for the fans. I don't have sympathy for, you know, in sports, a lot of people just like to make it about, you know, it's on the field, you know, that's where you got to perform, all that stuff. It is really hard to perform well if your club is a knuckleheaded club that makes really stupid decisions, like sacking Frank de Boer, who it was going to take time for him to implement his style anyway after 4 matches. That you can't overcome that. And frankly, the club itself deserves to be punished with the glut of fixtures they've got coming up.
Yeah, and the club was just, I mean, it was like, I think I used the word idiotic in an article. Like, it was idiotic. They hired a guy to be a long-term solution to take the club forward, and they didn't give him time, and they didn't give him his players. And then, essentially, like, based on what has been reported, one of the reasons that he was sacked is because the old player, like the legacy Crystal Palace players, who probably weren't going to be a part of his plans if you want a guy that's going to take the club forward, they're the ones who sort of complained about him to club to management and stuff, and that's one of the reasons De Boer was sacked. So it's ridiculous, and, like, they haven't been that, like, I put this in my column, on Monday, they have a positive expected goal differential. Like, they've been, now granted, they've played poor teams, but they've been like an average Premier League team. So I think they'll be fine eventually, but any club that is without a point potentially after 8 games is in a relegation battle and is going to be in a relegation battle for a pretty long time, until like February at the least.
Yes, but, you know, just worth pointing, despite having lost their first 5 matches and not having scored a goal, they're only 4 points back of, oh wait, Everton's in 18th? Man, West Ham's in 18th? You know, they're 4 points back right now. One draw, and they're right back into it, because those would be points gained, not necessarily points lost, if they lost to, you know, the Manchester, or if they get a point against the Manchester clubs or Chelsea, or even away at Newcastle after that. But in any case, we will wrap up the Premier League, and we're going to take a quick break and then come back, talk a little La Liga, and what's going on with Moussa or Ousmane Dembele.
Ousmane Dembele.
Not Moussa, Ousmane Dembele. All right, we'll be right back.
I was going to say, I decided not to because we didn't have time, but I was like, I want to see if they don't get a point from these next 4 fixtures, and they're sitting on 0 points and maybe even 1 or 2 goals after 8 fixtures. Does Derby County in 07-08, what do they have, 11 points come into play here? Like, can we root for the opposite here? You know,
yeah.
See if, like, we can make some history.
My bold prediction is that they're going to beat Chelsea in that home game.
Ooh.
I was going to say that, but it would have gone off track.
No,
but
complaints,
yeah, that's coming back from the international break. Like, Chelsea's players all over, Crystal Palace players mostly with the club, and like first home game in a month or whatever. I think that's going to be the game.
This podcast is brought to you by Water. Water, you save my voice, or at least you save it as much as it can be saved during these podcasts. Water, thank you for being you.
And we are back. All right, so we're going to move on to La Liga, where Barcelona continued their perfect start to the season, but it wasn't quite exactly how we expected. After an impressive victory over Juventus in the Champions League, and it was real impressive, where Lionel Messi continued his incredible start to the season. We got to the weekend and Messi couldn't quite pop up like we've been seeing him pop up early in the season. And Suarez was struggling as well. And then we saw probably, arguably, the best goal of the weekend by Gaku Shibasaki. Not the usual Getafe player, as the Spanish commentary reminded me pretty quickly. As so if you haven't seen this goal, look it up. It's one of those where you see one of those collision ball go straight up in the air, and before it even bounces, Shibasaki steps up, first-time volley, incredible top corner, just top-draw stuff. It between that and the Valencia goal, I think you can have an argument either way. I'd probably give it to Shibasaki because he's playing for Getafe against Barcelona. So normally you would look at this and say, okay, Barcelona's just going to come back and Messi's going to take over. That's not what happened. In order for them to come back, it was actually Sergi Roberto setting up Denis Suarez, who had come on for Andres Iniesta at halftime. Now, those two guys, Roberto and Denis Suarez, are a couple of the guys where people have just been convinced by them since they've come into the Barcelona team. So it was a positive sign to see some of the supporting cast take over. And then, late in the match, in the final 10 minutes, Lionel Messi puts in Paulinho, is how it's written. But Paulinho had a lot to do. He had a defender, two guys on him really, but he had a defender that he completely used his strength against, and then top drawer finish to the side netting across the face of goal. It was an incredible finish from a player that, although he's one of Barcelona's top five most expensive players of all time, has not really gotten the proper chance to play. He was a late second half substitute. He has not yet started a game for Barcelona. And the other storyline in this match was Ousmane Dembele leaving the match, now requiring surgery, and more than likely being out 3 to 4 months. Gerard Deulofeu, it's your turn to shine,
baby. You're back up.
Yeah, there's absolutely no one else to take your spot. So, Joey, I know you cover this match. What did you make of Barcelona? What do you think this means? What do you think the Dembele injury means? And then what do you think about Paulinho?
I think that it's good that Barcelona won this match. I think this is the kind of match you got to win if you're going to win the league in any league, because you weren't at your best. You weren't even probably at your B level. I think Barcelona was, frankly, pretty poor for a good bit of the match, even before Dembele went down, and we'll get to that here in a second. But as good as they looked against Juventus, I think that when Neymar and Suarez and Messi were leading the MSN line, there was such positional interchangeability. These guys could work off each other so well with 1-2s. It wasn't rigid. It was very open and free-flowing, and that requires kind of an understanding between players that took a little bit of time to develop at Barca, but once you saw the best of it, you saw as great as they were back in 2015, the year they won the Champions League. It's irrational to expect that in only the second game with Dembele up there instead of Neymar with those other two guys. But still, it was disjointed. There was a lot of players running into the same space. I didn't think that it looked very flowing and very smooth at all. And I thought, you got to give Getafe credit because their shape was very good. I thought that they did the classic, contract and get behind the ball without parking the bus. I'm not accusing them of that, but they were able to get behind the ball effectively and kind of cut off the channels that Barcelona likes to slice into and then expand going forward and be kind of dangerous on the counter. And they actually had a couple of the more dangerous chances in the first half before
Shibasaki.
Before Shibasaki scored the opening goal, he actually worked a nice 1-2 down the left flank and was able to cross it in, and it deflected off Gerard Pique, and it almost it trickled a little bit wide of the net. So he had that happen right before he caught that beautiful, beautiful volley to put him up. And then later in the half, Messi produced one of his moments of brilliance with a free kick that was saved very well in the upper left-hand corner. And so you kind of got a feeling it was not quite Barcelona's day. But credit Ernesto Valverde, because at halftime he made the Denis Suarez substitution for Iniesta, got a little more attack-minded. When Deulofeu came in for Dembele, they became a little bit more structured in the way that they had sort of gotten used to. I think Suarez and Messi were kind of pushed up a little bit more in advanced position with guys making runs around them. And even though Messi was still, part of all that, as you pointed out, the first goal came when Sergi Roberto was able to make a run down the right flank and cross and cut a ball back in that Suarez, frankly, had a brilliant first touch. Denis Suarez. Denis Suarez. Had a brilliant first touch where he set it up for himself and buried it in the left-hand corner. So those substitutions helped them get back on track. And then the Paulinho goal was just – that's why you get to sign – you know, I'm not comparing Paulinho to the best players in the world, but he showed quality on that goal. I mean, you said it. Like, Messi did play him through, so it was a nice heads-up ball by Messi. He kind of saw the space opening up. But, man – Paulinho took a great touch away from to the right side, and it was kind of away from goal, but it was also away from the defenders, which helped him get the space to at least be able to get a shot off. And the way he cut that ball, the power he generated from that angle into the opposite corner of the net is commendable. And for all the, you know, in my recap, I said for all the gruff we've given this guy, for all the criticism, it's not worth $48 million by itself. This is not a Gary Neville, Fernando Torres backed up his entire fee by scoring that one garbage time goal for Chelsea in the Champions League. Not that level. But that's a good start for him as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I just want to add, you know, that strength that he displayed, if Messi puts that ball into, frankly, any of the other nine players on his team, they don't actually hold off the defender there and push him off, because he took
took a couple pinballs.
He just completely shrugged off a defender. You want to talk about shrugging off? This was textbook shrugging off your defender and having the presence of mind to set himself up in the same go and then finishing. You know, this is the same guy who scored a hat trick for Brazil in qualifying not very long ago. He is a guy that can get forward, get you goals, and be strong in the attack from the midfield. I personally have been one of those people that have been very positive on this signing. Now, price be damned, but I've been positive on it. And I think that we saw the first sign. Henry?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's difficult to talk about price this summer just because of all the inflation. And, you can't really compare him to past Barcelona signings just because they're bought in different markets. And as you said, like, Paulinho is a player who, I think so much of the Paulinho skepticism is based on that, really just that last year at Spurs. And then he went to China, he resurrected his career, he was really good in China. Like, I mean, I didn't watch any of these games in China, but that's what everybody said. And he's a regular starter for the best national team in the world right now. So he's, like, I think, you know, it's as you said earlier, he hasn't been playing regularly all the time, but I think he's going to be... I think he's going to be a big game player for them. He's going to play when they need more steel in midfield. And he's a guy that, as he showed on over the weekend, he can play both sides. He can get forward and score goals. He can also break up plays without the ball. So I think he's going to be, yes, as you said, like maybe 40 million euros or whatever is a bit too much money, but he's going to be a valuable player for them.
Yeah, I mean, to put some context into it, the reason they had to pay that much was because they hit the buyout clause, and that's how they got him back. His club was not trying to sell him. So in order to bring him over to Barcelona, they had to hit the buyout clause, frankly. Now, you know, I want to expand a little bit and get both your guys' input on this. Dembele is out for 3 to 4 months. We're talking January he's coming back. That's a long, 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 long ways away.
It stinks.
Now you look at them not being able to get Philippe Coutinho, and, you know, if they were really trying to get both, and you look and say, wow, they really are stuck with Delafeo. That's who they got, and credit to him. He's, you know, he started the season looking pretty good with Messi and Suarez. But do they have enough? And how would you set this up? Would you drop Delafeo, maybe go Messi and Suarez up top, and then add Paulinho to the midfield? Because I think for me that seems to be the most logical transition. But it changes everything Barcelona does. At the same time, we're talking about a player that's going to be out for 3 to 4 months. That's, you know, we're talking, he's coming back around the time you're gearing up for the Champions League knockout rounds. So this squad needs to completely change between now and then, because the plan was of that front three isn't really there anymore. I don't think it's viable. Or is it? So I want to get your thought first, Henry. Do you think that this team needs to completely change the way it's set up, incorporate Paulinho, or do you think that they just go with the same setup that they've had in preseason, have Delafeo, who started the season well, and just bring on Paulinho slow?
Yeah, so I'm a Delafeo doubter, I guess I'd say. I don't think that he can be a regular contributor for them, like playing week in and week out on the left wing until Dembele gets back. But that said, I think, you know, I don't know enough about Ernesto Valverde to say, you know, how tactically flexible he is and how much he's going to be willing to change the shape. But I do think they're going to have to find a plan B and maybe a plan C that's not just, you know, a like-for-like replacement for Dembele on the left.
Yeah, the one thing I'll add before I throw it to Joey is that even though they were in a, you know, a tied game, Paulinho came in for Rakitic. He didn't, you know, it wasn't like they necessarily, it was a pretty much a like-for-like switch. And it seems like Paulinho might be a long-term replacement in that type of role. Because even at halftime, when you took off Iniesta, they didn't go to Paulinho. They went to Denis Suarez. So it seems like fitting him in hasn't quite been the focus as yet. I'm not sure if that's just a matter of his fitness isn't up quite to the levels that they want it to be or what exactly they're working on. And clearly with Dembele, who's a late signing and, you know, he missed training camp even with Dortmund, I believe, or he had some issues where he had sat out for a while. I that injury seems to have somehow been related to his preseason, you know, buildup. But with Paulinho, I'm not entirely sure because they seem like it wasn't really too much of a fuss. They hit his buyout and he was there. How would you set this team up for the next 3 to 4 months, Joey?
Well, I think the Rakitic point is a good one because I do think that you can. You probably give more appearances to Rakitic, but if you have basically the same guy in Paulinho, or at least a guy who you want to fill kind of the same role, then that kind of spells both of them, and it gives you good options no matter which way you decide to go in a given match. And I think part of the reason Paulinho came on Saturday was because Rakitic, there was a couple of instances, you know, even more than that, 3 or 4, where there were some heavy challenges. He could tell he was getting frustrated. I almost wonder if Valverde looked at that and said, okay, we might win, we might draw, but we can't go down to 10, man. We can't make this any worse than it already is, so let's give Paulinho a shot. And it's kind of a case-by-case basis in that regard. And I think that, you know, the point about Valverde being tactically pragmatic, that's what we're going to find out. That's a good one because the first game that they played in La Liga was against Real Betis, and they played with basically Messi and Suarez as the two main strikers, and they had Paco Alcácer and Gerard Deulofeu sort of play off them a little bit wider, and Sergio Roberto was kind of an advanced central midfield role more than like a number 10, like a strict number 10 role. But Roberto's done a good job making plays, so maybe you give him a little bit more of that kind of capacity and responsibility and see how he responds to it. I don't think there's another player in the squad that, you know, I think the reason they went out and bought Dembele, obviously, is because they wanted to kind of see if they could maintain that ferocious three-man front, and now I'm just not sure it's realistic. So I do think that, you know, you have those two options with Rakitic and Paulinho in the midfield. I think if you play the speedier players out wide of Messi and Suarez, it opens up space a little bit for them. But one of the things I wrote after that opener, too, was that, well, this is how they're going to have to get along for the time being until they find out what they want to do. Well, they found out what they want to do, and what they want to do is now out the window again. So the question is, do they go back to that? Or, you know, I personally think Sergio Roberto has been very good when they've given him, at least in the league this year, when they've given him that license to kind of be more of a playmaker. So I'd like to see what you can get out of him and maybe use this as kind of a, you know, they've done a good job of building up a lead in La Liga. I think they're 4 up on Real Madrid, if I'm not mistaken, and 5 up on Atleti or something like that.
No, also 4. They're
also
both.
Also 4? Okay. Yeah. But either way, you know, that's a result or two to play with in terms of experimentation. So, you know, there is a little bit of breathing room. There never really is in La Liga when it comes to, like, the pace that these teams set in terms of point collection. But, you know, they put themselves in a good spot to be able to kind of tinker with things a little bit before they really get to the meat of the season. And, you know, I don't think they have El Clasico to, what, December 19th, like almost Christmas this year or something like that. So there's a little bit of time to experiment. But, you know, those changes that I mentioned, I think, look, bottom line is this. How many teams in the world, besides Real Madrid, probably would say no to having Messi and Luis Suarez as your two primary attacking options? You know, they're still in a good spot. It's just it's a matter of, like, figuring out the structure behind them so they don't have to be absolutely brilliant every single night.
Yeah, and Messi was doing the same thing where he did, not last year as much, but a little bit the year before, where he's kind of a little bit deeper in the right side of the midfield and looking for those cross balls. But, you know, I think we've touched on Barcelona enough for now, so let's just move forward and you know, looking at the table. So Barcelona started out with 4 wins and 4. Sevilla is actually second now with 3 wins and a draw and 4, still unbeaten. Real Sociedad came into the weekend with 3 wins in 3 matches, but and they were hosting Real Madrid. Now, that is not an easy match to go play, especially with Real Madrid already having a couple of draws to their name to start the season. But inspired by Gareth Bale, Real Madrid, who had struggled a week earlier, Real Madrid pulled off a 3-1 impressive victory. Ronaldo's still suspended for this match, but I believe his suspension is over now, so he should be back. Based on what we saw Real Madrid do in the Champions League, which was impressive, just demolition job with Ronaldo, you know, playing the starring role, do you think that Real Madrid is still the best team in Spain and, frankly, in Europe? And, you know, a little bit to add on to that, we're talking about four-point difference. Well, these two teams, Barcelona and Real Madrid, will play each other twice. The Real Madrid wins those two matches, and they're in top of La Liga. And from what we saw in the Super Cup preseason, Real Madrid looked way better than what Barcelona had to offer. That was before they got Dembele and Paulinho, but we just said Dembele is out for 3-4 months. So, Joey, I'll start with you. Now that Ronaldo will be back, even though there's a four-point gap, is Real Madrid still the best team in Spain, Europe, the world?
Yes, they are. I mean, it's almost like they've been bored. And, you know, Marcelo missed this match because he got a red card last time out of frustration. Sergio Ramos, as you know, the Alex Baker corollary or whatever we're calling it, you know, he's either going to score a late winner or get
binary.
A red card. Or the binary, yeah, one of the two. Ronaldo, you know, got sent. It's almost like these guys have to, and I'm not saying they're doing this, but it's almost like they have to generate some kind of interest themselves, because when they're operating at their optimal level, then they're better than the rest of the world. And part of the reason that that's the case is the way that they lined up this past weekend, the amount of incredible players that are still in the side, even with some of the guys who are not playing and some of the guys who are out of form, and the fact that they can lean on guys like Marco Asensio, who gave a good account of himself, and Gareth Bale, who is almost an afterthought in the attack at certain points, which is ridiculous because he's one of the best attackers in the world. You know, they give Theo Hernandez look good when he was given a chance to start this weekend. I'm probably going to butcher this name, so I apologize. Borja Mayoral, is that how you pronounce it? I'm not sure. But, you know, Zidane said that he gave a good account
of
himself.
I'll just let you butcher it.
I'll butcher it. But he scored a poacher's goal, and, you know, I think that with young guys kind of getting a chance in this game, it gave Gareth Bale maybe a little boost of confidence to say, like, okay, you know, I don't see Ronaldo over there. I don't see Benzema over there. I'm kind of like the guy in this attack, so to speak. And that kind of opened things up for them a little bit, I would say. And, you know, they look good against the team that so far this season, Real Sociedad, no one's confusing them with a title contender, but so far this season, they had collected 3 or 9 points, right? 3 wins from 3 games. And Real Madrid, which has kind of been wishy-washy, goes there and gets all 3 points. So, you have to give them credit for that. And just the fact that they're able to do that when they're seemingly in such disarray elsewhere just speaks to how much better they are than everyone, if you ask me.
I think the key to Real Madrid is a clean razor when you're shaving your legs.
Clearly.
Because I think Marco Asensio being in the lineup is very important for this team.
Yeah.
And those got to watch out for those ingrown leg hairs. Henry, anything you want to add in terms of what do you think about Real Madrid, who got off to a pretty slow start, but with Ronaldo, they still look, frankly, unbeatable.
Yeah, I agree with Joey that they're absolutely still the best team in the world. But I would say that, like, just because they're the best team in the world doesn't necessarily, like, you can be the best team in the world and still not win La Liga, because beating a Bayern Munich or even a Barcelona, like, in a Champions League quarterfinal or semifinal is a much different skill than beating a Real Sociedad or a Getafe or any of these, you know, mid-tier Spanish teams. And there's a chance that when you have Luis Suarez and Messi, perhaps Barcelona is still better equipped to beat those type of teams. I don't know that that's the case. I would still pick Real Madrid in La Liga, and like pretty convincingly, but just because, so, but, and as Joey said, like, you can get, like, they won the league last year. There's a chance that they just get bored with some of these teams. And, you know, if they drop 2 points here or there, you know, it could add up and they could not win La Liga, but I do still think that they are, you know, pretty clearly the best team in the world.
Right. That's all I'm worried about is, like, And we even made – in earlier podcasts this season, we were talking about how they're not really going to be challenged until the Madrid Derby in – which is also, I think, in December or at least November. So if they kind of get it into their heads like, oh, we can – it's the old NBA mantra, flipping the switch. Like if they think that they can just flip the switch – yeah, you don't want to give Barcelona too much space before you have to start catching up to them. And I'll just, you know, again, going back to the point from this weekend, like when you can say that you're missing a bunch of quote-unquote key players and you're still trotting out Sergio Ramos, Casemiro, Isco, Marco Asensio, Gareth Bale, you're in a pretty good spot.
Just got to keep those razors clean, guys.
That's right.
So quickly, we'll just touch on a couple other points in Europe. PSG is still perfect, although... Henry, you want to talk about a little bit of the back and forth going on?
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, I do actually think it's kind of interesting. So for those that didn't see it, Neymar and Edinson Cavani first of all, Dani Alves, like they had a free kick at the top of the box. Dani Alves took the ball, wouldn't give it to Edinson Cavani, gave it to Neymar so he could take the free kick. Then they win a penalty, already up 1-0. It was Mbappe who won the penalty. Cavani grabs the ball, takes it to the penalty spot. Neymar goes with him, says, presumably, no, I'm taking this. Cavani says, no, I'm taking this. Cavani ends up taking it, missing it. Then after the game, Cavani reportedly storms out of the stadium 20 minutes after the final whistle, like doesn't speak to the media or anything. And then we find out today that Neymar doesn't follow Cavani on Instagram, which is classic, petty social media, you know, veiled messages. Now, we don't know that if he unfollowed him or if he never followed him, but either way, it's kind of like, it's kind of a thing. And, I mean, it's interesting because Cavani was previously the guy for PSG and presumably wants to be the guy, but Neymar was brought to PSG to be the guy and went to PSG because he wants to be the guy and is getting paid to be the guy.
He costs enough to be the guy.
Yeah, so he's... Like, Neymar is eventually going to take penalties if Neymar wants to take penalties. It's just a matter of if Cavani is going to put up a fight. And if he does, then maybe there are problems. But, yeah, it is sort of an interesting dynamic. But, anyway, PSG is going to win Liga.
Yeah, they've still won all six of their matches.
Yeah. I just think it's an interesting, maybe perhaps underreported or underwritten about idea that Zlatan got the majority of the credit when he was there, and then he left. And, you know, not that him and Cavani had any major dysfunction, but maybe Cavani thinking, okay, you know, this is my team, blah, blah, blah. Neymar comes over, and now Mbappe comes over. Cavani's, like, sort of the lost brilliant striker of this generation, in a way. You know, he's kind of been second fiddle. And again, it's not a judgment on his talent, but he's been a little second fiddle, even with the national team. He plays with Luis Suarez, so it's kind of like... I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting situation for him to be in. And if this is any indication that there might be some cracks that have been papered over, it's something to watch.
I think it's more just a little Brazilian, Uruguayan, you know, rivalry stuff going on there.
I think you have a point.
a little bit of neighborly squabbling. Well, let's take another quick peek around Europe. And I'll touch on Serie A real quickly. Juventus still perfect. Inter Milan, also still perfect. And then Napoli, with Dries Mertens getting his own hat trick this weekend, also still perfect. Those three teams look like they are the best in Italy on Europe's boot. Luciano Spalletti, quick shout out to him for Inter. He, you know, after taking Roma to second place last year, has come in to Inter and looks like he's doing everything they need to get done over there. He's got Ivan Perisic scoring goals. Icardi continues to score goals, but Inter look really, really good. And Serie A actually looks like a fun league in terms of competition for a change. I don't think there's too much more to be said because it's early days there as well. Quick look at the German Bundesliga. Borussia Dortmund remains unbeaten, still at the top, tied with Hannover with 3 wins and 1 draw. Bayern has the 3 wins and 1 defeat. So only 1 point back. It's not by no means as the Bundesliga decided in favor of Dortmund at the moment. But it is an interesting, quick start. Either of you guys want to gush over Christian Pulisic or...
Happy birthday, by the way.
It is Christian Pulisic.
Yes.
Also, happy birthday to Ronaldo. Yes, that Ronaldo. the number 9 Ronaldo.
Oh, the Brazilian, the most befuddling haircut in World Cup history, Ronaldo.
Oh, man, he used to be my favorite player. I'm not going to lie.
Oh, like, he was a monster.
Growing up, like, Ronaldo was genuinely my favorite player.
When I, and just to speak to that, when Cristiano Ronaldo came onto the world scene, I was kind of thinking to myself, there can't be another Ronaldo. What are you talking about?
I refused to call him Ronaldo for the majority of his career. Like, the majority. The last year or two, I was like, fine, I'll give in. Because if I'd say Cristiano, people wouldn't know who I was talking about for the most part.
Yeah.
They'd be like, you mean Cristiano Ronaldo? I'd be like, no, I mean Cristiano only.
Yes.
There's only one Ronaldo.
I would also like to say, and maybe Henry will back me up on this, the other Ronaldo, credit him, he's the guy that scored the two goals that should have gone against the United States in the World Cup final in 2002, were it not for a handball from Torsten Frings. I never forget Torsten. Hi, how are you?
Okay. Yes, backed up. You're backed up, Billy.
Some bitterness here. Shocking, yes. I know. Shocking. In any case, I think it's time to wrap up. I think we've set our pieces. So for Henry Bushnell in Chicago, Chi-Town, for Joey Galino here in Playa Vista, this is Shahan Ahmed, and this has been the FC Yahoo Podcast. Thanks for listening.